Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. If summer reading is your thing, this is a great year for it. No gas tank to fill, just you and a book in the best spot you can swing, whether that's the backyard or the beach. A book may be your best escape route this summer, and we've got recommendations from New Jersey to Mumbai, books that will take you to the ends of the earth and the edge of science. This hour, On Point, our book mavens share their top picks for summer 08. You can join the conversation. What makes a great summer read for you? What are you looking for, recommending this year? I'm joined today for our whirlwind book tour by some great readers. With us from Washington is Deirdre Donahue. She's book reviewer for USA Today. Deirdre, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
From Grand Rapids, Michigan, we have Tim Smith, buyer and manager of Schuler Books and Music in downtown Grand Rapids. Schuler Books is one of the nation's largest independent bookstore chains, going strong for 26 years now. Tim Smith, thanks very much for being here.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
And with us from New York is Liesl Schillinger, a regular contributor to the New York Times Book Review. Liesl, it's great to have you with us again. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Tom.
We've got some great lists here, and I hope you'll give us some readings as well. So let's dive straight in. Deirdre, tell us about a few of the books at the top of your list this summer. And I should say to our listeners, you can see the full list of recommendations for each of our three guests, Tim and Deirdre and Liesl, at our website, onpointradio.org. Deirdre, what's up near the top of yours?
The White Tiger. I think it's a debut novel by Aravind Adiga. I read it. It's absolutely stunning. It's sort of a combination of The Godfather and, Native Son. It's this powerful book about an Indian entrepreneur. He is incredibly poor. He comes from a small village, and he rises, and it details his rise and how the conditions of his life in India force him to be, ruthless, murder. He has an incredibly compelling voice, all narrated.
You call it an amazing and angry novel about injustice and power. You said, think young Vito Corleone in The Godfather refusing to be a puppet, but subtract the sentimentality. Do you have a little reading, a little bit of it there, Deirdre?
Yes, indeed. Okay, you'll see my friends when you visit. Fat, paunchy men swinging their canes on Brigand Road, poking and harassing vendors and shaking them down for money. I'm talking of the police, of course. The next day I paid a local to be a translator. You know, I'm sure, that people of the North and the South in my country speak different languages, and went to the nearest police station. In my hand I had the red bag. I acted like an important man and made sure the policeman saw the red bag by swinging it a lot and gave them a business card. Then I insisted upon seeing the big man there, the inspector. The red bag had done the trick. And then he sits there, and the big man sat at a huge desk with shiny badges on his khaki uniform and the red marks of religion on his forehead. Behind him were three portraits of gods, but not the one I was looking for. Oh, thank God. There was one of Gandhi. It was in the corner.
We'll hear more about Gandhi in this hour, but there's Deirdre Donahue reading from The White Tiger by Aravind Adiga. She says it's got the same effect as Richard Wright's Native Son and Ralph Ellison's Invisible Man. High praise indeed. Tim Smith, what's high on your list, my friend?
One of my favorites from the list is a book called City of Thieves by David Benioff. And this is his second work that's gotten wide acclaim, and tells the story of two gentlemen that are in prison during the siege of Leningrad.
World War II in Russia.
Yes.
Soviet Union.
They're waiting their execution when they are giving an impossible task of searching out for a colonel whose daughter is getting married and needs a wedding cake. They're sent out to find a dozen eggs where there are none to be had. And so they chronicle that journey.
You call it a coming-of-age tale with a completely contemporary feel, even though it's set in Leningrad in World War II. Do you have just a bit to read for us, Tim?
Yes, I sure do. It starts, I live in Los Angeles and write screenplays about mutant superheroes. 2 years ago, I was asked to write an autobiographical essay for a screenwriting magazine, and midway through, I realized I had led an intensely dull life. Not that I'm complaining. Even if the summary of my existence makes boring reading, school, college, odd jobs, graduate school, odd jobs, more graduate school, mutant superheroes, I've had a good time existing, but as I struggled through the essay, I decided I didn't want to write about my life, not even for 500 words. I wanted to write about Leningrad.
That's from David Benioff's City of Thieves. How does he get from Los Angeles and screenwriting back in time to Leningrad, Tim?
Well, it starts from the perspective of a screenwriter, which, interestingly enough, the author is one. And he is having to write this autobiographical essay and starts to talk with his grandfather about it and keeps prying his grandfather to tell of this story of World War II, and that's what comes out in the book.
And what is it about City of Thieves that puts it so high on your list?
I just think, as a work of fiction, it's just fantastic. The way that he uses the language just expertly, as well as that combination of a modern fiction book set in time as a historical novel is just it's fascinating to me.
Liesl Schillinger, what's high on your list this summer?
Well, I'm pretty overwhelmed by a novel by Andre Aciman. He's written books before, but this is his first novel. It's called Call Me By Your Name. And one of the women in my book club recommended it when it came out in paperback this year. And it's just, I just love it. It's going to be one of my books that I reread.
This is the Egyptian-born Andre Aciman. He wrote the memoir Out of Egypt, but this is his first novel. What's the story?
Well, it's the story of a first love of a beautiful and serious, introspective young boy. He's about, I think he's 16 or 17. His father's a scholar, and his parents live in a villa in Italy. And every summer, they invite a graduate student from someplace to come and spend a few weeks at the villa. And basically, a young 24-year-old brilliant graduate student comes to stay with the family, and he and the boy fall in love, although they don't know what to call it. But this transcends, you know, sexuality. This is about strong, genuine first feeling, the kinds of things that don't happen often more than once in a lifetime, if they happen at all.
Elio and Oliver fall in love. Do you have a bit you could share with us, Liesl?
Yes. Elio's father pays for the two of them to go to a book reading in, I think it's in Rome. I don't quite remember the town. But after Oliver leaves, the father tells the son, implies that he kind of understood what was going on. The father says, "You had a beautiful friendship, maybe more than a friendship, and I envy you. If there is pain, nurse it, and if there is a flame, don't snuff it out, don't be brutal with it. Let me say one more thing. Remember, our hearts and our bodies are given to us only once. Most of us can't help but live as though we've got two lives to live. One is the mock-up, the other the finished version. And then there are all those versions in between. But there's only one." It goes on, and I've condensed what happens in two pages, but it was just so moving, the idea that we need to live as if every moment counted.
Call Me By Your Name by Andre Aciman, there, Egyptian-born Aciman, at the top of Liesl Schillinger's list. Dear Donahue, what do you look for when you look for a summer read? Are your recommendations different than they would be going into crisp fall or in the deep of winter?
No, pretty much I like things that I open it up and I can't stop reading. It has to sort of grab me from the beginning, and I really feel that it's always the voice of, you know, the sort of narrative drive. I guess in some ways I do like paperbacks for the beach, but
yes.
Carrying, you know, things like that. I'm actually one of those strange people who really enjoys reading nonfiction rather than fiction for relaxation.
Rattle on down through your list a little bit, some of the nonfiction that you're recommending this summer.
Actually, I really liked Gandhi and Churchill. That was an amazingly interesting and perceptive presentation of these two titans of the 20th century. And I learned so much about Gandhi's childhood, and which was, in some ways, he was a much more cherished and adored child. I mean, you know, everyone knows that Winston Churchill had a terrible relationship with his abusive father. But the loneliness, and also the idea that Arthur Herman, the author, has some very perceptive insights, like, for example, how when Winston Churchill was stationed as a cavalryman in India, he read the whole, you know, decline and fall of the Roman Empire. Mm. And that actually created a lot of those issues he had in terms of, you know, his terror of the fact that he would be the person who would lose the British Empire.
Gandhi and Churchill, the epic rivalry that destroyed an empire and forged our age. You're willing to go there to some serious history and the insights on personality that come with it and affairs of state right there. Tim Smith, what about down your list a little bit? What else can you offer to us?
Well, there's a book coming out this week by David Sedaris, When You Are Engulfed in Flames is the title. This gets back to kind of a book like we have seen from him in the past, where he highlights the dysfunction both in his life and around him, and presents it in such a way that is incredibly funny.
It's a collection of essays again, yes, from David Sedaris.
Yep, kind of. It has a feel of the book Me Talk Pretty One Day, which is a book that was released a couple years ago.
And he's writing, I mean, I've seen he's writing about quitting smoking, very human things, but he takes them out to extremes that can be absolutely delightful before he's finished.
Oh, absolutely. It's I think, you know, you'll find yourself rolling in laughter with this book, as is the case with most of his work.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about great summer reads, 08, with Liesl Schillinger, regular contributor to the New York Times Book Review, Deirdre Donahue, book reviewer for USA Today, and Tim Smith, joining us from Grand Rapids, Michigan, buyer and manager for Schuler Books and Music in downtown Grand Rapids. They've each brought us their top recommendations for this summer, and you can see those at our website, onpointradio.org. Let's take a call from Linda in Beverly, Massachusetts. Linda, you're on the air.
Oh, the book that I'm recommending is Twilight of the Superheroes by Deborah Eisenberg. It was published in 2006, and it's a collection of short stories. And I have made friends with such a variety of people, and my measure of a good book is that when I finished it, I wanted to start all over again, and I did exactly that.
Twilight of the Superheroes, Deborah Eisenberg. What is it about the book, Linda, that grabbed you?
It's that the characters are so distinctly different, but the joy was in her technique of writing. I particularly like short stories because I think there is such a challenge to write a short story, do it well, and recognizing that it's a tighter form of writing, and it's also the variety of people whose lives you enter, and I feel as if I made a lot of new friends, and I did indeed start the book all over again, and I, you know, I make no distinction between summer reads and winter reads. There are just good reads. And I have no hesitation now when I start a book. I'm old enough now to say, you know, I don't like this book. I'm going to put it down because I don't have as much time to read now.
But if you like it, you'll do it all over again. And you did it with Twilight of the Superheroes. That's pretty high praise indeed. Linda, thanks for that. Let's get a call from San Francisco, California. Dave, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom.
Hi.
Hey, it's early in the morning here. I'm still sitting in bed. And in fact, I spend most of the night reading a book or two books. And both of them have to do with India. And that's what caused me to call you. Both of them, one is called Indian Summer, The Secret History of the End of Empire. And it has Gandhi and Nehru and Winston Churchill. And they're all there. And it's by this young woman. This is her first book. All it says, she's beautiful. I'm looking at her picture. Alex Van Tutselman. And all it says about her is that she was educated at Oxford and lives in London. And
Indian Summer, another vote for India's history. What else have you got there, Dave?
I have another, and it's India, too. This you'll like a lot, Tom. I know what you like. This, I don't know if it's called A Blue Hand, The Beats in India. And it's about Allen Ginsberg and Peter Arlovsky. And they meet Gary Snyder and Joanne Kiger there. And it's their first trip to India, and it really turned on India. And it's their kind of eccentric meanderings through India way back in 1961.
That's great. Dave, give us the title again, Blue Hand?
Blue Hand, The Beach in India. And that's by a woman, too, Deborah Baker. And it says that she lives. She's also beautiful. And she moved to Calcutta in 1990, and she lives. She also wrote a biography of Laura Riding, you know, Robert Graves' poetic partner.
Blue Hand, Beats in India. I love the idea of it. It sounds like you're judging a little bit by the dust jacket there, but you've got us into the beats as well. Dave, thanks very much for that. Liesl Schillinger, on your list, you've got a kind of a tangent on the India theme. Jhumpa Lahiri is back with Unaccustomed Earth, and it's very high in your recommendations.
I was thinking of that when both of the callers were speaking, because the first woman said that she loves short stories, and of course our second caller is entranced with India, and I second both of those thoughts. One of the things, I love Jhumpa Lahiri's writing, and I've read Interpreter of Melodies and The Namesake, and now this. This one, I really is so accomplished. She's so good. What I like about her short stories is a lot of short story writers, I feel that they spin out a little thing that happens and make it fill the pages. Mm. With her, you feel that there is so much more beneath what remains. Is she's just having to cut away all of these stores of, like, buried history. Everything feels so rich and so dense. And as for the allure of India, you know, she's from Bangladesh, I believe, originally. But what is true of Bangladesh is also true of India and the idea of India. I think that, in a way, that country has really strong familial relationships, which make their fiction continue to be as strong and elusive as 19th century fiction that we all love. And I think a novel that comes from that history has that added freight and weight and humanity.
Jhumpa Lahiri's family from that northeast Bengali culture straddling India now and Bangladesh, and her theme through all these being. What happens when Indians come into the American culture and have to kind of straddle these two?
Absolutely. And I don't think that her stories have their power solely because of the alien element of the characters mm-hmm. having this Bengali origin. I think that they really stand as kind of human characters whose problems really are universal. I mean, certainly they get color from that additional background. But, you know, this is really one story that I wanted to read from, if there's time, is
yes,
called
please.
Hell Heaven
mm-hmm.
from the collection.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a young girl remembering her mother, who had an arranged marriage to an older man, her mother's innocent, chaste romantic obsession with a young student who kind of hung out with their family for a summer. And the girl writes in retrospect, It's clear to me now that my mother was in love with him. His name was Pranab Kaku, by the way. Mm. He wooed her as no other man had, with the innocent affection of a brother-in-law. He was respectful of my father, always seeking his advice about making a life in the West, about setting up a bank account and getting a job, and deferring to his opinion about Kissinger and Watergate. He brought to my mother the first, and I suspect the only, pure happiness she ever felt. I don't think even my own birth made her as happy. I was evidence of her marriage to my father, an assumed consequence of the life she'd been raised to lead. But Pranab Kaku was different. He was the one totally unanticipated pleasure in her life.
I hear that dense texture of the 19th century work in there that you're talking
well,
about.
Well, no, I I got, you know, behind myself or ahead of myself.
But, no, I don't think
well,
so.
Well, the mother was in the 19th century.
Yeah. Unaccustomed Earth, Jhumpa Lahiri. The mother was in the 19th century, you're saying?
Well, what I mean is she's still under that kind of family mm-hmm. obligation and mm-hmm. texture, but transplanting herself, she integrates with the new expectations and has runs into trouble trying to make that knit.
Deirdre Donahue, take us a long way from India right into New Jersey. You've got one high on your list called Fear and Yoga in New Jersey by Deborah Gallant? I'm not sure. What's that?
It's incredibly funny. Imagine if Christopher Buckley decided to start going to the Short Hills Mall. It's this woman writes, it's very sort of suburban. There's young, you know, this middle-aged woman. She decides to open up a yoga studio in, you know, an affluent suburb of New York, of New York City.
Okay.
And everything goes wrong. And she's worried, you know, her husband gets, his job gets outsourced from Newark Airport. Her son becomes absolutely crazed about Nina Gettleman, the heroine of the book, is Jewish, and her son starts going to a lot of bar mitzvahs, and he's desperate to have a bar mitzvah, mostly because he wants to get all the goodie bags and the money and stuff.
Yeah.
And it's, there's something very, I mean, she's very, very clever in a nice way. I mean, her first book, Rattled, was hilarious about McMansions. She manages to write about people and write about sort of, you know, all the kind of like, you know, middle class, upper middle class fixations about your children and schools and your appearance. And, you know, everyone is sort of these intensely stressed out, new people in New Jersey. And, you know, she's running this yoga studio, which, of course, it floods. You know, her feng shui gets bad. And it's just a very, it's very light. It's kind of, I don't know. It's comic writing, a humorous comic novel, is actually incredibly hard. I mean, I always think that P.G. Woodhouse is unbelievably underestimated because he keeps it all going. And it all works.
Let's hear a little bit of it, if we can.
Okay,
Fear and Yoga in New Jersey by Deborah Gallant.
In an exaggerated pretense of civility, or else her interpretation of Marcel Marceau in imitating a burglar, Debbie tiptoed over. "I really didn't want to interrupt," she said. "I knew you'd be mad, but," she lowered her voice and made the universal gesture for waves or a snake, maybe, "there's a flood in the waiting room."
Watch out, watch out. The chakras are in trouble. That's from Deborah Gallant, Fear and Yoga in New Jersey. Let's get a call from Amherst, Massachusetts. Carl, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom, and hello to all fellow readers.
Good.
I'd like to recommend a book. It's not new. I think it's a couple years old. Joan Didion's The Last Thing He Wanted, which I think is an excellent summer read. It much of the action takes place in the Caribbean. And it's told, Didion tells it in an elliptical style that demands your attention and really draws you into the setting. And the narrator of the story, the first-person narrator, brings in all sorts of... it's set in the time of the Iran-Contra scandal, which might appeal to older readers for whom that sparks some degree of emotion. And it's about the life of a woman who gets caught up in the periphery of the scandal. And the first-person narrator brings in a lot of supporting material in the way of newspaper clippings, obituaries, segments of the Iran-Contra report, and so on, that you'd think might make it dry, but it doesn't. It really, instead, gives it a sense of authenticity.
It's hard to touch Joan Didion without getting caught up, even if it goes back to Iran-Contra in 1980s history. She's just got a way of spinning it out that intellectually is so captivating, at least to me, Carl.
It is, absolutely. It really, she makes a lot of interesting points about, well, without actually hammering them home, about how things were done and whether that was good or bad. The detail makes you believe that even if it didn't necessarily happen, it could have.
The Last Thing He Wanted is on Carl's list, Joan Didion. Thanks, Carl. Let's go to Harvard, Massachusetts, and Ames. Hi, Ames. You're on the air.
Hi. I have a great read for Jane Austen fans and for history buffs. It's called Dancing into Battle by Nick Foulkes, and it's the subtitle is A Social History of the Battle of Waterloo. And it's just short chapters in paperback, great for the beach. Nonfiction, but it's sort of unbelievable because it is true that the Duke of Wellington was at the Duchess of Richmond's ball on the eve of the Battle of Waterloo. And the reason that he wrote that it was the nearest run thing he ever saw, that battle. So very... interesting about the 100 days in Brussels leading up to the battle and how close the British aristocrats were to that great battle.
Social history there from Nick Foulkes and Dancing into Battle. Ames, thanks very much for that. Tim Smith, you've got a history, kind of an unorthodox history on your list. 1434 by Gavin Menzies. What's the gist?
This is the second book in a group of books that he's started. The first one was 1421. And 1434 picks up a little bit further down the line. His interest is China. And he tells the story in this book and, I guess, follows through history. how the Chinese had sailed to Europe in the year 1434 and provide the spark for the Renaissance.
And this is a reappraisal of the notion that it was the rediscovery of ancient Greek and Arabian works. He says, no, actually there was a fleet from China that showed up in Italy and offloaded everything that sparked the Renaissance. That's pretty revolutionary idea.
Pretty big claim. And also, you know, he's a gentleman that has spent quite a bit of time in research on both. In 1421, that was no small claim either, that the Chinese were the first to take a fleet around the world and, in fact, had discovered America well before Columbus.
A new way of understanding the Renaissance there from Gavin Menzies in 1434. Liesl, you've got an Anne Enright book high on your list called The Gathering. Tell us about it.
Well, It's a great book, and it won the Man Booker Prize, and it should have. I mean, the writing is just astonishing. I wanted to jot down almost every line, but can I refer to something Tim just said?
Yes, please.
Well, I think his 1434 book sounds fascinating, and I talk to you all mostly about fiction, and I review mostly fiction. Mm. But for summer reads, I do read a lot of nonfiction, and I'm really looking forward to Fareed Zakaria's book, The Post-American World. And I was thinking that 1434 is kind of the pre-American world. But
China looming large in both.
Yeah. The Immer China. But I was just actually on vacation in Greece and Turkey and took 8 books with me. And the only one I cracked was a collection of Joan Didion stories that I was rereading, Slouching Towards Bethlehem.
Oh, yeah.
And that's always fun to reread. And you know, you can read one chapter on even the shortest jitney ride. But anyway, to get back to The Gathering, it's very serious. It's beautiful. It's a story of a woman, a middle-aged woman, whose beloved brother from her huge Irish family has killed himself. And she is just thinking about what happened in their childhood, what went wrong, what happened that shouldn't have, but also realizing that you can't actually collect judgments on this lived life, on this past history. And so she's just reflecting on her tie to him and on her tie to her current family, her husband and daughters. And it's a very dark book. And it's funny because it's about emotional matters, but there's a harsh humor, a dark humor to the way she writes. That's really striking.
The Gathering by Anne Enright. And Deirdre, on your list, we've got something much more contemporary, a book by Dan Kennedy called Rock On, an Office Power Ballad. We just got a minute before the break, but what's that about?
It's all about what happened. He's this absolutely devoted music madman who gets this great job at Warner Music and discovers he feels like a fraud. And it's all about the death of the music industry.
It's about marketing rock and roll in the 21st century, and it's not pretty out there.
No, and the sad part is, you know, this is the sort of, you know, this was, you know, he's working for the same label that, you know, did Led Zeppelin, all sorts of great stuff, and they're sitting there trying to figure out things like, you know, how to sell, market, like, you know, Jewel's deodorant, you know, how do you brand all of these pop things, and it's, his passion for music is so clear, and yet it's all gone, the man, you know, the music, the sort of authenticity. It's a lot about, I guess, 21st century corporate life and how strange it is for this guy.
Dan Kennedy's Rock On, an Office Power Ballad, and he discovers who you can say what up dog to and who you cannot in that corporate world of music these days. Deirdre Donahue, Tim Smith, Liesl Schillinger, please stand by. We're talking about great summer reads. Oh, wait, there are lists all up at our website, onpointradio.org. Check them out and let us know yours. What's the top of your beach bag for the summer? I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Talking about great summer reads, 08, with Liesl Schillinger, regular contributor to the New York Times Book Review, Deirdre Donahue, she's a reviewer for USA Today, joining us from Washington, and Tim Smith is with us from Grand Rapids, Michigan, buyer and managers for Schuller Books and Music in downtown Grand Rapids. Let's get a call from Montpelier, Vermont. Claire, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I'd like to recommend a new book by Ethan Kanan that's coming out this month called America, America. It's about a working class kid who he's working for this very politically powerful family in upstate New York. And there's these great characters, and there's a senator who's running for president, and he's a very kind of Ted Kennedy-esque senator. And it's very much it's a coming-of-age story, and there's rich, wonderful characters and just stunning writing, and it's a great book to sink your teeth into.
It's not even out yet, and you've seen it. Does that mean you're a review, a critic, a bookseller, what, Claire?
I'm a bookseller. I have I own Bear Pond Books in Montpelier, Vermont.
And what do you find people coming in looking for this season? Is there a
lots
flavor?
Lots of political books right
mm-hmm.
now. But the good fiction always sells, too.
Yeah, America, America by Ethan Kanan, your recommendation there, and it's on its way out. Let's get one call from Boston. And Cara, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you doing?
Very well. What are you reading?
I am reading a beautiful novel by Deborah Weisgall, who's a local author, and it's called The World Before Her.
Mm-hmm.
And it's set in 1880 in Venice, and it's about the life of the writer George Eliot. And in alternating chapters, Deborah Weisgall juxtaposes a modern story in 1980 set in Venice, and it's absolutely a fantastic book.
What grabs you about it? Is it the language? Is it her insights? What's pulled you in, Cara?
It's very much a literary novel, and she incorporates all elements of the arts, and it just kind of takes you off your feet. You can't put it down.
Deborah Weisgall in The World Before Her. Liesl, Deirdre, Tim, do you know it?
I don't know it, but I've just been reading Judith Martin's book, No Vulgar Hotel, which is her love song to Venice.
Yes.
And that I want to go to Venice after reading that book. And after hearing Cara's recommendation, I want to read that too. People who love Venice and people who love to write, that's a nice combination.
You've got one out of the history column with Jane Boleyn, of all things. Introduce us to Jane Boleyn. This is by Julia Fox, Deirdre.
Oh, this is the perfect book for people who liked The Other Boleyn Girl by Philippa Gregory. And, you know, people are just mad for the Tudors. I mean, you know, all of the movies, the novels, every day it seems there's a new Tudor book coming out. But this is actually a very interesting kind of defense of poor Jane Boleyn. It was Anne Boleyn's sister-in-law who was married to her brother George. George was executed. Jane Boleyn, Lady Jane Boleyn, has been gone down through the centuries, you know, absolutely demonizes this vicious creature who had, like, testified against her sister-in-law and her husband. And in fact, this woman makes a very effective case that it was all wrong, that everyone sort of has presented this woman as sort of scheming. And she ended up actually being executed because she became the lady-in-waiting for Catherine Howard. But the most interesting thing, though, is the way Julia Fox really conveys the unbelievable level of powerlessness for women in Tudor England. Even if you came from a very well-off aristocratic family, everything was your husband. And this woman didn't have children. You know, her husband was executed as a traitor, and she sort of had to make her own way at age 30. So she became a lady-in-waiting for Jane Seymour and then for Catherine Howard. And it's just so interesting. I mean, she was kind of a career woman and in a very difficult time, because otherwise she had no money,
When a career meant something, is a little different, a little different path maybe than today. Jane Boleyn, The True Story of the Infamous Lady Roquefort by Julia Fox there on Deirdre Donahue's list. Let's get a call from Salt Lake City, Utah, and Daniel. Hi, Daniel. You're on the air.
My book this summer, my favorite so far, is World Without End by Ken Follett.
Ken Follett, is it new, old? Is he's back?
It's new. It's part two of Pillars of the Earth that he wrote in 1989, which is about the Masonic movement, the building of the cathedrals in England back in medieval times. And you pick up the same families 200 years later or 150 years later and follow them for another one full lifetime. You start with them as kids, and by the time the book's done, they're gray-haired oldies.
And Daniel, are you new to Ken Follett, or have you been reading him for donkey's years?
No, I think I've read everything he's written, the good and the bad, because he has written some pretty trashy stuff. I will say there's a little salacious sex in the books that maybe could be toned down. I compare them to William Rutherford's series on England and Ireland. I don't know, Princes of Ireland, Sarum, The Forest, London. I read those over the last year and just loved them. And I like Follett's style better. It flows better. It's a better story, you know.
Daniel, we've got it. Recommending Their World Without End by Ken Follett. Tim Smith, Ken Follett, been selling books for a long time. Do they still move off your shelves in Grand Rapids?
Yes, of course. One of the books, you know, I think he, the caller touched on one of the ones that has been, of course, the most recent and most requested. But, yeah, his books do still move very well.
You've got a very different recommendation here on a young family that moves into a kind of completely overwhelming grand Gilded Age mansion in Akron, Ohio. Tell us about it. All the Way Home, it's called.
Yes, All the Way Home is the title, and yeah, it's kind of a tragic and funny book at the same time, as well as life lessons as you go along, and the whole time you find yourself wanting to yell out to the author, "No, don't do it!" But as the book goes along,
this is is it David David Giffels? I'm not sure how to pronounce that.
Yeah.
All the Way Home, building a family in a falling down house. They move into this enormous mansion that doesn't even have plumbing or electricity. It's got rain just sluicing in through the roof. And why do they do it?
Well, they are at the point where their family is outgrowing the home that they're currently living in. And as they're driving around looking for a new place, they sort of stumble upon this magnificent Tudor mansion, and they just can't resist it. And so they start to chronicle the process of if they should buy it, and if so, then what needs to be done to it, and all of the things that are going to go along with that. When they first look at it, there's, as you said, there's no running water, and there's animals and humans both living in this house in a grand scale. And so it's a very overwhelming task.
All the Way Home, it's called, and they end up looking at what home really means there. Liesl, you've got a very gritty urban book on your list, Black Flies by Shannon Burke. Tell us about it.
Yeah, well, Shannon Burke worked as an EMT in a really rough area of New York up 150th, I don't know, it was very high up in New York, where there's a real code of macho-ness. And the other guys who worked there had been EMTs for a long time. And I literally just saw for the first time the movie Serpico right before I started reading this book, which, by the way, came across my doorstep unsolicited. I didn't mean to read it, and then I just started reading it and just got really drawn into it. But it's just really dark. There's a kind of hazing that goes on with the other guys who are in this emergency medical team. And when I reviewed the book, I talked about how what Shannon Burke seems to be doing to me recalls what Michael Hare was doing in Dispatches, just giving the lie to the sort of macho appeal of carnage and showing how depressing and disturbing and how terrible the human cost is in loss of life that an emergency medical crew might see, or that a soldier on the ground might see.
Shootouts, so bad cops, humane. Unhinged yep. medics, hopeless patients, dark humor, bizarre circumstances, and this medic's struggle to balance his desire to help against his own growing callousness. And it turns out to be that's a real battle.
Well, it's really terrible. He's got a girlfriend when the story opens who's very proper. She made it into medical school. He didn't. So he's kind of sulking. And so for him, it's kind of a rite of passage, proving to her that he's his own man, I think. That's a subtext. But he's in a way rebelling against expectations by doing this tough, dangerous job. He's kind of lost, and he finds his way. But she shows him at one point that he's almost losing himself because he's actually a really good guy. And he wakes up at some point during the novel, and I don't want to people of the pleasure of finding it, but he kind of wakes up and his humanity is recalled by the shock treatment he gets.
Deirdre Donahue says, find a paperback. You've got a couple on your list. One, They Did It With Love by Kate Morgenroth, a very different setting here, Greenwich, Connecticut. Tell us about that one, Liesl, if you would.
Well, that's a funny situation. It's actually A friend of mine wrote that book, and I never read my friend's books just in case I hate it, and then I could never look at them again.
Right.
And I opened it, and I started reading it, and I couldn't put it down. It was as fun as an Agatha Christie. I had no idea what was coming. When the end came, I was actually surprised. And
Agatha
also,
Christie meets Desperate Housewives, you've written.
Yeah, it's kind of Stepford Wives, only the women are vicious. So they look perfect, but they're scheming. And, I guess that maybe does describe Desperate Housewives. But you know, so I actually recommend it to my mother, and she and I actually disagree on many things, but she liked it enough that her book club loved it, too. And it's basically about a lot of the petty rivalries among women in book clubs, as well as being a murder mystery.
Watch out. Young trophy wife Julia fun. Found swinging from a tree in her front yard, so it's not just tea and crumpets here.
No. Watch it before you sip that tea.
Yeah, right.
There may be a taste of bitter almonds.
Right. Let's get a call from Middletown, Connecticut. Terry, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hey, I'm happy to just thrilled. I was looking at Elmore Leonard's son, Peter, came out with his first novel, and I was a little skittish at first and was pleased to find out that the apple did not fall far from the tree. It's a real intriguing novel. I'm still in the middle of it, called Quiver.
Quiver, by Elmore Leonard's son, Peter. I haven't come across him yet. Does he have Elmore's spare style?
Well, he goes off with his own voice, which is nice. And in fact, your gentleman from Michigan should be aware of him, I hope. Another Michigan-grown author. And it's a lot of intrigue, murder, unrequited love, kidnapping.
A murder mystery and crime. Tim Smith, how about it? Peter Leonard, is he on your screen yet?
Absolutely, yes.
Do you know the book, Quiver?
Yes, we just got it just a couple weeks ago, and it's doing pretty well so far.
That's great. Terry, thanks for your call. Let's get one from Columbia, South Carolina, and Benson. Hi, Benson, you're on the air.
Hey, how are you doing?
Very well. What are you reading?
You know, I'm actually reading two books. I actually just finished up two books. The first one was James Fry's new book, Bright Shiny Morning, and it was really cool. It was kind of a snapshot of life in Los Angeles through the eyes of, I mean, really a massive amount of characters, and it's just really cool. It's really easy to read. It's broken up in pretty small sections and written in kind of that quasi stream of consciousness thing that he's done in the past, and just really enjoyed it a lot, and I think a lot of other people would as well.
Might work for Summer on the Run. And what else have you got there, Benson?
The other one is kind of an X-rated book, and I would give you a plot, but even it's kind of a little risque, but it's called Snuff by Chuck Palahniuk.
And the sounds scary.
Is because it's real short. It's only about 200 pages long, so it's a great, just real, you know, real easy to pick up and read. I think I read it in a day or two. You know, so it's a great book just for picking up, you know, on the beach or whatever. And the good thing about it is if you like other Chuck Palahniuk books, you know, like Fight Club and Choke and stuff like that, it's got a big, a real wild plot and a big twist and everything that you'd expect from Chuck Palahniuk.
They sound like grabbers, Benson. Snuff and Bright Shiny Morning. Thanks very much for those. Deirdre Donahue, you've got, speaking of scary, you've got some scary stuff out there from Richard Preston, one called Panic in Level 4. Tell us about that.
This is a series of essays that he's done. They're updated and expanded. Most of them originally appeared in The New Yorker, but he goes back to, you know, he is the king of the hot zone with the Ebola virus, and he discusses sort of new updates in terms of the Ebola virus, other emerging, you know, illnesses, viruses, bugs, whatever, that are coming. And then he talks about this really interesting and very sad genetic malady that makes people become self-cannibals, and yet it's called Lesch-Nyhan syndrome. And yet it's a beautiful essay at the end, because we all have, it's this thing where you feel compelled to, you know, literally chew off your fingers and your lips, and yet all of us, in fact, have a certain aspect of working against our own best interests. And he really taught, the fact that he's able to do, he befriended these two men and he goes off and does these different things with them, It's just a beautiful essay about being human and how these men who, you know, incredibly disabled. I mean, they don't want to bite, you know, their fingers and lips. But it's that idea that seeing past the freakishness into who they are. It's just so interesting. It was a very, I felt it was a level of writing that, like, is way beyond the hot zone.
Richard Preston, Panic in Level 4, Cannibals, Killer Viruses, and Other Journeys to the Edge of Science. Liesl Schillinger, take us out with an old one or two here. We've just got half a minute, but you've got Somerset Maugham and Graham Greene making the tail end of your list here, and why not? Who wouldn't want to go back to them?
Well, most people, when they think of Somerset Maugham, think of either The Razor's Edge or of Human Bondage, but one of my favorites is a breathtakingly mean-spirited little Romana Clay about literary London in the 20th century called Cakes and Ale. And one of my favorite lines from it, which I'm always quoting, is, it is hard to be a writer and a gentleman. And that is, when you write about people, you just really can't always be a nice guy.
He says, I began to meditate on the writer's life. It's full of tribulation. But he writes at the end, the writer is the only free man. And Graham Greene's The Heart of the Matter. You're ready to pick it up again.
Absolutely. I reread it every year. I've read it in Spanish. It's heartbreaking. It's about people's incapacity to love even when they wish they could, to be a good person. My favorite line in that book is when Scobie says to his wife, whom he loathes but doesn't want to, he says, in human relations, kindness and lies are worth 1,000 truths.
And there's a hammock full. Tim Smith, Deirdre Donahue, Liesl Schillinger, thanks to all of you. Summer reads all. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.